From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The World Series is approaching, that time when we all pay attention to the crack of the bat, the arc of the ball, and the cries of the TV commentators when a fair ball is called foul. Are the umps getting it wrong more often than usual this postseason? Former baseball commissioner Faye Vincent certainly thinks so.
Major League Baseball has to treat umpires as a serious part of the business. They do not. The total cost of revising the umpiring system probably would be about equal to one broken down shortstop, but that's just not what the owners want to spend their money on.
Also ahead on Only a Game, we'll check in on the college football season at halftime and strolling over rolling hills with a trusty beagle at your side. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In some college football towns, preseason promise has given way to midseason malaise. But in others, the enduring enthusiasm is earned and earnest. Joining me now to discuss which teams are living up to or living down their billings is Chris Dufresne of the Los Angeles Times. Chris, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me.
Florida quarterback and 2007 Heisman Trophy winner Tim Tebow seems to have recovered from the concussion he suffered earlier this fall, but he's not putting up the kinds of stellar numbers that he has done in the past. Florida visits Mississippi State today. Are the Gators still the team to beat?
Well, I think they are, and it has as much to do with the way everyone else is playing. There is really no great team out there. I thought it was interesting that on the first weekend that the bowl championship series standings came out, that the top four teams in those standings were all coming off very lackluster performances. It was almost like they should have waited another week or two to release the standings because the teams weren't ready yet.
Hope that somebody had a great week and then release them.
Yeah, it was the top four. You know, it was Florida and Texas, Alabama and Boise, and all four of those teams had struggled in winning their games that weekend. You know, Alabama is doing well in spite of losing its quarterback and running back. They lost some players. Florida was bringing back everybody on defense and almost everyone on offense. So there are some issues there. I think they have a chance to regroup and get things rolling as they proceed down into November and get towards the SEC title game.
Another Heisman Trophy winner has suffered a serious injury this season. Oklahoma quarterback Sam Bradford is expected to have season-ending surgery on his throwing shoulder after injuring it twice this fall. What does the loss of Bradford do to the Sooners' chances?
Well, it devastates them. It's really sort of a sad story. Here's a guy that's coming off a Heisman Trophy winning year. Bradford was so good last year. He threw 50 touchdown passes, which is a remarkable statistic. And now they're sitting there at 3-3, and they've lost to three really good teams by a total of 5 points. So it's not like they couldn't be 6-0 and be right in the national title race. When Oklahoma won the national title in 2000, they didn't have a significant injury all year to any starter. And sometimes you have years like that, and sometimes you have years like this.
Assuming the surgery on Sam Bradford is successful, what's more likely, that he plays another year in college or that he goes into the draft next time it's available?
He's got a very interesting and difficult decision to make because he's got to make a business decision now. Is, do I risk another year of possibly getting hurt again and walking away from guaranteed millions, or do I have to make the leap now? You can sense that he's struggling with that decision already because I think he's a kid that really does like college and he loves the atmosphere. And I don't think he should be criticized for even wanting to come back or having come back when some people think he should have taken the money last year.
As you mentioned, the season's first bowl championship series rankings were released on Sunday, and Boise State came in at number 4. The Broncos are 6-0, but they have a weaker schedule than many of the other high-ranking schools. Is Boise State a real contender for a national title?
Probably not. They're in a situation where this is the highest a, quote-unquote, one of these non-BCS schools has ever been, but it's a little bit misleading. It's almost like they've risen. You talk about the glass ceiling. It's sort of like they've hit the glass ceiling at number 4. and it's going to take a lot of things to happen for them to get to two, even though it's only really two spots. They're vulnerable to being passed from behind by a one-loss team that has a better schedule. USC could pass them, or Cincinnati, which is undefeated and from the Big East Conference. So I think the scenario that Boise State gets in, I think a lot of the other teams are going to have two losses. Let's say Florida runs it out, and they're undefeated at 13-0, but everyone else has two losses. I think in that scenario that Boise would get the number two spot and play an undefeated Florida.
Transcripts of an NCAA investigation into academic standards for athletes at Florida State were released last week. One academic advisor testified that some football players are reading at a second grade level. The Seminoles overcame an 18-point deficit to beat North Carolina Thursday night for their first ACC win this season, but Florida State's 2-4 start prior to that win had raised questions about legendary head coach Bobby Bowden's future. What will it take to turn things around at Florida State?
Well, I think more than the academic scandal that's going on there at the school, the most important issue at Florida State is 2-4, and this is the way it is.
You've got your priorities straight, no question.
No, this is absolutely correct. I mean, if the team is number 3 in the country right now and they were 6-0, there would be no talk about this. Bobby Bowden's future, number one, and the academic scandal would have been put in the proper context, which it was a campus-wide scandal. It involved many more athletic teams than football. There's no doubt that this is the worst start in the history of Bobby Bowden's remarkable run at Florida State. He had a losing season his first year in 1976, has never had a losing season since. And yet when you are about to turn 80 years old, all of a sudden you've lost it, and you need to hang him up. And Joe Paterno went through this at Penn State in the early part of this decade, and he was able to recover from several losing seasons, and he was ultimately allowed to turn it around. And he's got his program back on top, a top 10 Rose Bowl team, Big Ten champion. But when you're approaching 80, I think the reality is that does he have time to turn it around? And by the time he turns it around, he's going to be 82 and 83, and there's no way he's going to be coaching that long. But Bobby's future will ultimately be decided by his win-loss record this year. If they continue to lose, I don't think he will have the political capital to come back another year, which is what he really wants to do.
Chris Dufresne covers college football for the LA Times. Chris, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Okay, thanks for having me.
One of America's most famous college fight songs turns 100 this season. John Philip Sousa called On Wisconsin the most stirring, enthusiastic college melody he had ever heard. But the original composition was, in fact, intended for the University of Minnesota Gophers, the Badgers' chief rivals in the Big Ten Conference. It was 1909, and Only a Game's Kirk Carapeza takes us back.
On the shores of Lake Mendota in Madison, the University of Wisconsin Badger Band prepares for a special halftime show. More than 300 band members are performing marching drills on a soggy practice field, just a few blocks from Camp Randall Stadium, the home of the Badgers football team. Band director Michael LaCrone barks orders over a loudspeaker from a two-story-high watchtower, like an old sea captain commanding his crew.
That's wrong. It's da, 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 hey! Da, 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 hey! Do it again, same thing. 10, 1, and 2, and 1, 2, ready, 10.
Between drills, LaCrone explains the story behind On Wisconsin. It was 1909, and William T. Purdy had just graduated from Hamilton College in upstate New York. It was a tough year to be a college graduate. Like today, there was rising unemployment and diminishing wages. And so, with no immediate job prospects, Purdy packed his bags, hopped a train, and moved to the Midwest, to Chicago, where he lived in a rooming house. He worked as a piano coach and tried to launch his career as a music composer. When Purdy went broke, he decided to enter this composition in a contest sponsored by the University of Minnesota. At the time, the Gophers were searching for a new fight song. The prize? $100. LaCrone says what happened next was an act of fate, or syllables.
Well, you know, it just doesn't work for Minnesota. It's something in the gods said this is a non-Wisconsin song.
Divine intervention?
It was divine intervention.
It was one of Purdy's good friends, Carl Beck, not God, who intervened. While visiting Chicago, Beck convinced the cash-strapped composer to forget the prize money and withdraw his entry from the Gophers contest.
Carl Beck, who was an alumnus of Wisconsin, and he was sort of a poet and a lyricist, and he said, no, Bill, he says, you can't submit it. He says, he's got to go to my school. And it just happened that they were looking for a song up here. Purdy submitted it up here, and as soon as they heard it, it caught on. Beck supplied the original lyrics.
And the rest, LaCrone says, is history. By 1959, the fight song had become so popular in Wisconsin that the state legislature passed a bill making it the official state song. Now the university is planning a celebration for November 10th. LaCrone says it was on that day, in 1909, when the Badger Band premiered on Wisconsin before a football game against, of course, Minnesota.
Well, we're going to have a big birthday celebration at the Memorial Union on that afternoon to celebrate. We're going to have cake and sing on Wisconsin. And we're going to make it a year-long celebration all through our concert in the spring. You're going to hear about how important on Wisconsin is to the University of Wisconsin.
But it's already loud and clear how important the fight song is to the university, though the university's attorneys have disproved it. A rumor that Michael Jackson bought the rights to On Wisconsin in 1985 still circulates through the Madison campus. While the King of Pop never purchased it, LaCrone says the On Wisconsin theme appears everywhere in American pop culture.
You'll hear fragments of that little da-da-da-da. You can hear it in all sorts of funny places you wouldn't expect. There's a moment in Phantom of the Opera where it occurs. I noticed in the one of the Tarzan movies. And then it's in the Broadway production Miss Saigon. There's a moment where it's a very dramatic woman and they play that four-note theme, da, 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 da. They don't necessarily play it in the same rhythm, but it's there, and those of us that are Badgers, we know what it is.
Even those of us who are not Badgers might have to concede that there is, in fact, something infectious about the mixture of Purdy's composition and Beck's lyrics. And if you happen to be at Camp Randall on game day, surrounded by a sea of red, that melody just might sweep you up. For Only a Game, I'm Kirk Carapezza.
To see pictures of the University of Wisconsin Marching Band or to learn more about the Wisconsin Alumni Association's celebration of On Wisconsin, visit onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour.
Dip, 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 dip.
Wanted, quarterback, no experience necessary. Well, a little. In fact, the ad in the student newspaper at the University of Akron specified that the football team, the Zips, were looking for a guy with significant game experience as a high school quarterback. But it's probably negotiable. That's because the original starting quarterback was suspended for violating team rules. His backup shredded his knee on October 10th. The third string guy is a freshman, and his backup is a student coach. Have arm, willing to travel to Eastern Ohio and run a team that's already lost 13 scholarship players to mischief or mayhem? Have the Zips got a job for you?
Well, when I get the paper, I read it through.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Little League dad's exceptionally candid memoir. But first, tonight, baseball's defending champions, the Philadelphia Phillies, will watch the Yankees play the Angels to determine which team will face the Phils in the World Series. Those Phils will be in the same position tomorrow if the Yankees don't close out the American League Championship Series by winning Game 6 tonight. This postseason, except for the ongoing Yankees-Angels wrangle, has been characterized by the brevity of each series. Unhappily, this postseason has also featured umpiring calls that have ranged from dubious to demonstrably wrong. For example, in the second game of the American League Division Series, Joe Mauer of the Twins slapped a ball down the left field line. Umpire Phil Cuzzi called it foul. TBS announcers Ron Darling and Chip Carey did not disagree until they and the millions of people listening to them watched the replay.
That was a fair ball, by the way.
Wow.
Fair ball, not even close. Off the tip of the glove in fair territory and then lands fair.
Wow. So a huge break for the Yankees. Joe Mauer should be at second base.
Except for the fact that it was wrong, perhaps the most significant aspect of the call was that it did not involve veteran arbiter and Iowa native Tim McClelland. During this postseason, McClelland has made several gaffes, perhaps the most dramatic of which saw him failing to recognize that it's okay for a catcher to tag out two runners at third base, assuming neither of those runners is touching said base at the time. According to fellow Iowan Bryce Miller, the executive sports editor of the Des Moines Register, McClelland seems to be something of a magnet for unusual and disputable circumstances on the field.
He was at home plate in the George Brett Pine Tar incident and kicked him out of that game, which is one of baseball's kind of enduring memories, and Sammy Sosa's cork bat and David Wells' perfect game. He seems to have had a knack to be in the middle of something that has drawn a lot of attention.
Perhaps it's sympathy for that misfortune that inclines Bryce Miller to cut the umpire some slack.
Tim McClelland would be the first one to tell you, you know, that was a clear mistake on his part. I mean, there's no dispute or doubt about that call. Both runners should have been out. But, you know, I'm not sure I would agree with the premise that umpires aren't supposed to make mistakes. I mean, that's the humanity of the game, and that's, I mean, what I told Tim on the phone, and this is true, I'm glad people don't have 16 TBS Fox cameras circling my desk and chronicling my mistakes every day in that kind of a way. Because if they did, you know, I'd probably be out of a job.
Nobody would argue that being a national target for partisan second-guessers armed with instant replay from multiple angles is a tough gig. But it also seems to be true that everybody would agree that this fall, the guys in that position have gotten it wrong more often than one might expect. Fay Vincent, Major League Baseball's commissioner from 1989 until 1992, feels the officiating during this postseason has been the worst ever.
I do, and by a huge multiple. I mean, I can't recall any postseason and when we've had this array. The call that Phil Cuzzi made on Mauer's hit was a very bad call in the Twins-Yankees series. There have been, I would say, 10 bad calls this postseason where I would have said the normal amount would have been less than half that.
Fay Vincent's view is that the problem with umpiring in general results in part from the system through which the officials must pass to reach the major leagues. Candidates for the job pay thousands of dollars to attend schools run by retired umpires, schools over which Major League Baseball has no authority. Then the young umpires work years for ridiculously short money in the minor leagues, and then, if they're lucky, they make the bigs, where some of them continue to work beyond the point where they should have retired, since their pension plan isn't particularly attractive.
Major League Baseball has to treat umpires as a serious part of the business. They do not. They have to buy those schools. That's step one. They have to totally redo the relationship with the minor leagues so that Major League Baseball controls the umpires. The total cost of revising the umpiring system probably would be about equal to one broken-down shortstop, but that's just not what the owners want to spend their money on.
Late this week, Major League Baseball decided that only umpires with previous World Series experience would work this fall's series, a short-run response to an immediate embarrassment. In the longer run, given the logic of the reforms Commissioner Vincent has suggested, one might assume they would actually occur. I asked him to assess the chances that this would happen.
Zero.
That's the ultimate short answer.
Yeah, that's the answer. In part because I'm pushing to have it changed. That's the worst thing that could happen. If I said everything was fine, the possibility of change would increase significantly.
Most people who've been watching baseball's playoffs this fall are probably hoping Mr. Vincent is wrong, because the result of the poor calls and publicity surrounding same is that each night fans tune in wondering not only which pitcher will be sharp and which hitter will snap out of his postseason slump, But which umpire will make the next incomprehensible mistake? For a lot of those fans, baseball is a passion too important to be sullied by bad calls. Though some of those fans, Des Moines Register executive sports editor Bryce Miller, for example, have means of buffering the pain, or at least trading it for another form of suffering.
See, I'm a Cubs guy, so I've disconnected from the baseball postseason in almost every earlier and in almost every way possible. So when your team's out, you pay a little less attention. I'm mostly joking, but mostly, as much as you can joke as a Cubs fan.
Unlike Mr. Miller, fans of the Yankees, Angels, and Phillies don't currently have the luxury of distancing themselves from the injustice of the bad call made or the suspense over the one that may soon come. As the postseason continues, they just have to hope the umpires have gotten all the bad nights out of their systems. In his new book, The Opposite Field, Jesse Katz tells the story of his days as a Little League coach who eventually became the league's embattled commissioner while trying to bring up his son, maintain peace with his estranged wife, carry on an affair with another Little League parent, and, oh yeah, hold down a job. Because The Opposite Field is a memoir, we also get stories of the author's upbringing, through which baseball certainly ran. Jesse Katz joins me now from KPCC in Pasadena. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Little League baseball is central to the life stories you have presented here, your own and that of your son, Max. Tell us a little bit about how you rediscovered baseball long after you thought you'd outgrown it.
Well, you know, there was something about becoming a father that, reawakened the baseball gene, if you will. I had left behind my Little League days decades earlier up in Portland, Oregon, and had sort of developed a bit of a, I guess, jaundiced view about baseball and sports in general, that it was kind of the realm of, frat boys, something bougie and frivolous. Maybe I'm not wrong about that, but, having a child, having a son in particular, I suddenly, just was overwhelmed by this desire to, fill him in on all of that and take these experiences that for me seemed very carefree as a kid, and making sure that he had a taste of that.
You ended up putting a tremendous amount of time and energy into La Loma in Monterey Park, California, the park where you coached and where your son played. How did your efforts change the community?
Well, first of all, we had a baseball program that was essentially disintegrating before our very eyes. There were families, hundreds of families, bailing out and equipment missing and debts piling up. It was really, sort of a nightmare story, probably not entirely unfamiliar to people, but, it often happens with volunteer organizations.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that we were in danger of really missing out on baseball altogether. On the surface, I'm fixing a baseball league, but inside, I'm dealing with some of my own, demons and predilections and longings and shortcomings, and baseball for my son and I has been this bond, this glue that's tied us together. And as my life got a little bit more difficult, and as my marriage was falling apart, and as I was struggling with a stepson who was straying, baseball also became this kind of buffer and insulation. It was the thing that was going to, be our refuge and protect us from all these other travails. So I had some selfish reasons as well.
You say at several points when you're trying to wrestle with your role as commissioner of the league, I'm a writer. I'm not a leader. And yet you managed to transform yourself into that role.
Well, as a writer, a journalist, we're trained observers. We're not used to being right in the center of things. My approach to journalism is usually fly on the wall. And suddenly I was thrust into the spotlight, and I was being evaluated as to what kind of person I was, and what my values and judgments were. And it was a very unfamiliar and uncomfortable feeling at first.
You present yourself in the book as the antithesis of the bad Little League parent cliche, which we're all familiar with. You don't scream at your players. You don't bench them for making errors. You don't make them walk home after losses. But late in your son's Little League career, I think he was 12 years old, you put Max on the mound when he was ill and had a fever. And when you got home, you found that Max had wet his pants. Could you read the end of the chapter in which you tell that story, please?
Okay. I left him alone in the bathroom and went to lie down. I took off my glasses and hid my eyes under my forearm. What was I doing to this kid? What thing did I think I was affirming? I had pushed him to some ridiculous limit, drained him of everything he had to give. He was too numb to be elated. I was too stricken. By the next season, if we did this again, he would be 13. And from there and beyond, not the same boy he was tonight, the boy who had grown up at La Loma, the boy who had made me what I was. Max bundled himself in sweats and curled up next to me on the same side his mother once had. I rested my hand on his back. For the first time in years, maybe for the last time, my son fell asleep in my bed.
Did that night change your attitude as a coach?
I don't know if it changed my attitude as a coach as much as it did as a father. I had a real keen appreciation at that moment that whatever we had experienced at La Loma, and yes, whatever ridiculous extremes I'd pushed him to, it was going to come to an end sooner or later. That probably before I, faster than I realized, you know, I wasn't going to get to be his coach anymore, and at a certain point, not be the father who really knew everything about him anymore. And so I think at that moment, I realized whatever seasons remained, whatever final games remained, I was going to try to be that person who kicked back a little bit and relished our time together.
Kicking back and relishing time with your son, it wasn't the easiest thing to do, especially when you were the commissioner of the league, because the challenges in organizing that group were daunting at best. With the benefit of a couple of years of perspective, can you say whether you made more friends than you did enemies during your tenure as commissioner?
Well, we'll have to see when the book comes out.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it, because this is an exceptionally candid memoir. You write about the intimate relationship that you had with your assistant commissioner, a woman named Carmen, who was married at the time and had lots of children. Is Carmen okay with this book?
Carmen and I have talked. She was a little taken aback by the detail that was included, but I think she understands. As do my son and my parents and everyone else who's important in my life, that, you know, honesty is, in the end, the best policy, and that these things that seem embarrassing or at least inconvenient are the things that make us human as well.
I'm speaking with Jesse Katz, author of The Opposite Field. You're listening to Only a Game. Do you ever just wander over there when there's nobody else around and kind of let your memories accumulate, because you have so many of that park?
I don't go there very often, but the times that I have dropped by have been very special. I was there last month with my son, Max. It was during the wildfires that were sweeping across the San Gabriel Mountains here. And it was a real ominous day, as a matter of fact. I mean, the sky was, you know, blackened, and there was ash hanging in the air. And my son's 16 now. He's a junior in high school. He's a big kid. And we took a bucket of balls to La Loma, and there was nobody that was there. It was just the two of us. And, you know, it felt like the apocalypse was, you know, descending on L.A., and we were able to carve out this little space, this kind of secret hidden park and have a few minutes of just absolute pleasure together.
You coached Max from his earliest T-ball days until he was playing high school baseball. How well have you handled the transition from coach to spectator?
It's not as easy as you might think. The baseball program has more or less crumbled at his school, and I volunteered myself one more sort of reckless leap to be the JV baseball coach during his freshman year, thinking that as a freshman, he might be good enough to make the JV team. So I was going to be the JV coach and get this one last season with him. And as it turned out, he was either good enough or the program was debilitated enough that he was able to leap right up to varsity as a freshman. And I was left with this very awkward experience of not being able to see him play because our games were on the same days but at opposite fields. Mm-hmm. And so I had done all this scheming to try to hold on together, extend his childhood by one more season, and I really sort of screwed myself over in that respect. So that was a good lesson for grabbing a bag of seeds and taking a seat on the bleachers and just cheering.
Jesse Katz is the author of The Opposite Field, a memoir published by Crown. He joined me from KPCC in Pasadena, California. Jesse, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Since the Harry Potter novels began selling 12 years ago, it's been a bit of a hard go for the non-fictional Harry Potter, 20, who lives in Portsmouth, Hampshire, in the UK. At first, I thought it might be quite a good thing to have the same name, he recently said. He learned this was not the case when he tried to buy a season ticket to see his favorite soccer club, Portsmouth FC. First, they didn't believe my name was genuine, he said, and then they thought it was hilarious. When he plays soccer in a local league, Potter says match reports are full of stuff like, Harry Potter cast a spell on the opposition. Well, I suppose that's better than getting bludgeoned by a quaffle.
Yeah, Harry Potter, you've got a cooking cave, Harry Potter, the Red Professor Snape, Harry Potter.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, Beagling. That's kind of fun to say, Beagling. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
I had beagles all the time growing up, Bill. They were all named Bo. It was easier that way.
You'll enjoy the story to come, I'm sure. The Yankees and the Angels will return to the Bronx tonight for Game 6 of the ALCS. Those who compile baseball's endless statistics and records tell me that history is on the side of the Yankees, but I'm wondering if they're feeling any echoes from, say, 2004.
You would think not, but it's hard to know. I think, more to the point, I'm wondering if the Angels are hearing any echoes from the last time they played in New York and threw the ball all over the stadium.
Philadelphia wasted little time and few games in getting to the World Series. They went one over the minimum in beating the Rockies and then the same with the Dodgers. Are the Phillies as good as they've looked?
If they get the pitching, and they've gotten the pitching from, especially from Cliff, from having picked up Cliff Lee and from having rescued Pedro Martinez from the ash heap, yeah, they're as good a team as there is in baseball. Their lineup is half a step behind the Yankees maybe, but not that much.
Speaking of the Dodgers, this week owner Frank McCourt fired his estranged wife, Jamie, from her position as CEO of the team. The soon-to-be ex, Mrs. McCourt, fired back, saying if she can't be CEO, that's okay, she'll settle for sole ownership. This can't end well.
Tell me this story isn't taking place in L.A. Seriously.
where else?
I mean, like the Los Angeles Dodgers don't have enough problems. They don't know which one of the estranged McCourts is going to own them.
The Mets didn't make it to the postseason, Charlie, but they should have a few pennies in the coffers for rebuilding. The trustee of Bernie Madoff's assets has said that the Mets actually profited from Mr. Madoff's Ponzi scheme to the tune of $48 million. I'm wondering if Mr. Madoff took the money from the pockets of Yankees fans.
I have no idea, but I'll tell you what, maybe they ought to disband the Mets as a baseball team and open as an investment house.
Can't go wrong. Last week, suspected cases of the swine flu hit the Cleveland Cavaliers. This week, the Cleveland Browns. 12 players missed practice on Wednesday, including 6 starters. But never fear, the NFL says that if at least 6 players are unable to suit up on Sunday due to suspected cases of H1N1 virus, the Browns can replace them with members of their own practice squad. So, no worries in Cleveland this week.
If you replace the entire Browns lineup with the taxi squad, nobody would notice.
What I'm wondering is, if you've bought tickets to this game, since you're getting second-string players, do you get a discount? Do you get a rebate or something?
Yes, because that's the way the National Football League has succeeded, by being a charity organization.
Last weekend, the Tennessee Titans lost to the New England Patriots 59-0. Shortly thereafter, Titans head coach Jeff Fisher showed up at a charity function wearing an Indianapolis Colts Peyton Manning jersey. I thought he had a perfectly reasonable explanation. What do you think?
He said he wanted to feel like a winner.
Yeah.
I like Jeff Fisher a great deal, and I've talked with him on several occasions on various stories. This is a very nice way of him saying, look, I don't know how long I'm going to be here. I've been handed a terrible team to rebuild. And if he's getting any heat from the football can be no fun of any kind people, he should just ignore it.
I'm sure you were shocked, Charlie, to read this week that the NBA's locked-out referees might very well be back at work on opening night.
I'm wondering this half-seriously, if the fact that we've had serious referee incompetence moments in both college football and the baseball playoffs the last couple weeks accelerated the NBA and the referees' negotiations in any way. Because the topic of should we use replay, are our referees capable of keeping up with the pace of the game, was very much in the headlines the last 2 weeks, and nowhere is there a problem with keeping up with the pace of the game, except for perhaps hockey, than in professional basketball.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that keeping up with the pace of the game argument as applied to baseball.
Well, I mean, if you've seen baseball umpires, you can tell that some of them have trouble keeping up with the pace of a tree.
The sensational headlines notwithstanding, it's not quite fair to say that this week Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban came out in favor of steroids, is it?
No, he's talking about medicinal steroids. He's talking about stuff taken under the supervision of a doctor. You know, in times of drug hysteria, people generally lose their analytical kind of minds. I think it's good for Cuban to be broaching this possibility anyway.
Charlie, Maxim magazine, which some people will be surprised to learn has words, asked LeBron James whom he would most like to dunk on. What do you make of the King's response?
Well, first of all, can't you imagine the moan of sadness that went up from the Maxim editors when he didn't say Megan Fox? Giving them another excuse to put her on the cover. King LeBron James would apparently like to dunk on former President George Bush. The problem there, of course, being that the ball might get stuck on the point of his head.
Marcus Jordan is only a freshman at the University of Central Florida, but he's already making some costly demands. The school's athletic teams are sponsored by Adidas to the tune of $3 million a year, but Mr. Jordan says that he will only wear his father's Nike Air Jordans. Imagine that, an amateur athlete who receives no sponsorship dollars wants to pick his own shoes.
Are these Air Jordans with an A or Air Jordans with an H-E-I-R? I didn't realize that Michael had been forced to sign over his firstborn son when he signed a Nike deal.
This weekend marks the end of Major League Soccer's regular season. The NFL brags about achieving parity, but when was the last football season that saw more than half of the teams in the league still fighting for playoff spots on the final weekend of the regular season?
Well, I mean, if you're following the MLS, it's been a very exciting season. Of course, if you don't follow the MLS, you will say, well, gee, isn't every game a tie anyway?
I'm not going to say anything.
Okay.
Marathoners always face lots of challenges.
My favorite story of the week.
But it is a beauty. Guys running at the front of the pack rarely have to pause a minute to let a train go by. Kenyon Simon Saw was shocked to see a freight train blocking his path just 400 meters from the finish of the race. Do you think he would have called for a do-over if he hadn't won the race anyway by sprinting those last 400 meters once the train had gone by?
I have absolutely no idea what he's thinking about America in situations like this, you know? But I'll tell you what, you've got to wonder what else has crossed his path during his training runs, I wonder. A train might be the safest thing, you know, going. Well, by the way, let me ask another question about this. Did they jog in place?
I assume.
Marathoners tell me that the worst thing you can do is stop.
Yeah, you got to keep loose.
So I just have a vision of these two guys just sort of jogging there as the train goes by.
Conversing quietly.
Yes.
And finally, Charlie, the University of Mississippi has shortened one of its fight songs in order to discourage football fans there from chanting, "The South Will Rise Again." Seems reasonable enough to me, but I'm wondering what you think about the student government's resolution that the chant should be replaced with, "To hell with LSU." That's pretty literary, don't you think?
Well, you know what? I'm going to be in Oxford for the LSU game on November 21st, visiting my son who's in graduate school there, so I'll be able to do an Only a Game special report on the effectiveness of the new fight song. And I'm sure our listeners will be waiting with bated breath.
You make sure you bring a microphone with you on that fateful day. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
More often than not, in our work here at Only a Game, we find dogs to be a distraction. They interrupt our ultimate frisbee stories by catching the discs. They run out to all sorts of different fields while all sorts of different games are in progress. But sometimes dogs get to be the stars of the show, as demonstrated in this story from WNYC's Sarah Montague.
How much is that doggy in the window?
Say Beagle to most people, and they think Snoopy or Uno, the first Beagle to win the coveted Best in Show award at the Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. They think greeting cards. They don't think Hunter. But Beagle's winsome features include the best noses in the canine world. Sporting historian Peter Devers.
The history of beagling goes back almost into unrecorded times. We believe that hounds were hunted as far back as at least 2,000 years. Xenophon, writing in his treatise on hunting, mentions small hounds like beagles that were used for chasing rabbits and small game by scent rather than by sight.
Beagling for sport was exported from England to America by a wealthy 19th-century leisure class, but with an egalitarian spirit.
It didn't matter that you owned 80% of New York Railroad stock. You might be a person who couldn't even afford to buy a ticket from Yonkers to the city. But if you were seriously interested in hunting and in hounds, you were welcomed.
Enthusiasts began to create their own packs, both private and member-supported, and including both beagles and bassets, hounds developed by the French. Today, there are some 40 packs recognized by the National Beagle Club. Hunting is seasonal and cyclical. It is spring, and Betsy Park, joint master and huntsman of the Sandinona Harehounds, a beagle and basset pack based in upstate New York, is training puppies. School begins with walking out from the kennels.
For the only purpose of this is to get the puppies out of the kennel and get them focused on remembering where I am, teach them their names, teach them to chase biscuits. Here you go.
In the best Conrad Lorenz tradition, these puppies learn much more from Betsy and identify more closely with her than with their distracted careerist mothers.
There has to be somebody in charge, and they have to understand that that is me.
In August, young hounds graduate to pre-season hunting, which is why at 6 a.m. you are in bed and I am standing in a field holding a whip and a tape recorder. The whip is just a noisy deterrent to hounds rioting, running deer, coyote, or fox instead of rabbits. Their ability to distinguish these scents is innate, Betsy says.
I think that capacity is programmed into them. It's probably in their DNA. For instance, they pay very little attention to birds, squirrels, things like that, with the exception of turkeys, which are extremely smelly and fun to hunt. But they know they're not supposed to.
Here you go, Daryl. Here you go. The boy. Ben.
This Sunday, a mix of young hounds and veterans is urged into the brush to pick up a fresh scent line. Even after 40 years, Betsy finds this process fascinating.
For me, it's watching them solving a puzzle, which they're doing every day that they're out there. They are discerning with their brains and their noses where their quarry has gone, and it's wonderful to watch them thinking about that and employing their skills to do it and talking about it.
The hounds aren't the only ones who need to refine their skills.
It's hard for people to tune in and watch the hounds. It takes a lot of attention. People, especially in the 21st century, are losing that capacity to pay attention.
Sandinona's diverse membership comes together the first Sunday in October for the club's opening meet.
All right. Nice crowd. I would like to welcome you to the 61st opening meet of the Sandinona.
They are from all walks of life. Farmhands and financiers, alpaca breeders and artists, lawyers and landowners, and have many different reasons for being attracted to the sport. Alison Granusi is a former dancer turned literary agent and was a little daunted by her first glimpse of beagling subculture.
I had a friend who knew I liked to walk and said, well, you would like beagling? Show up on Sunday at 2 o'clock at this place. And I did. And I got out of my car, and there are about 80 people in green jackets and tweed hats and wellies, and I thought, what in the world have I gotten myself into? And I ended up just loving it.
Well, thank you very much.
At the start of the hunt, the field, members and interested spectators, range themselves behind Gary Dykus, the fieldmaster. His job is to keep people out of the way of working hounds. Hunt staff known as whips, the job I was doing in August, flank the pack to help keep them in order, and the stream of 18 hounds, traditionally counted in couples, set off across the countryside for an unknown adventure. Lawyer Kevin Conkay and his wife Alice are longtime subscribers and cherish the intimacy of the experience.
It's pretty pure. You hear the hounds, you hear yourself, and you're very close to nature and you're very close to the hounds working when you are beagling.
Whip Molly Marion likes beagling kicked up a notch.
Really cold days with multiple rabbits on very steep hillsides. They're a lot of fun, they're very exciting, everyone works together, and it's really exhilarating.
Some days are more exhilarating than others. Today, our beagle pack toils for over an hour before the first viable rabbit obligingly runs across my feet.
Betsy? Tally-ho.
Okay, thank you.
Straight line that way.
The chase is part of the fun. And Gary Dykus appreciates the Cottontails' tactics.
They're quick and fast. They don't run in the open. They run through the fence rows. Some of them only run a little ways, and if they feel threatened, they go into a hole very quickly. But some of them are very sporting, and they'll run for distances.
The following weekend, it is the Basset Pack's turn to hunt. The meet is at an elegant farmhouse property, laid out like a parcheesi board, with dense wooded cover bisected by paths and separated by big fields. It's a crisp, dry afternoon, and the scenting is much better. So we hear more hound music, the pack in full cry. Beagles swarm, but Bassets galumph, and it's fun to watch them bound in and out of the cover, their long ears flapping. Abruptly, they lose the scent, which usually means that the quarry has gone to ground by jumping into a hole. In the cartoons, Bugs Bunny usually pulls the entrance to the hole in after him, and this is how hounds feel at a check. Betsy Park sympathizes.
Hey, Roper, I know.
John Ike, a former master of foxhounds, grew up with Betsy and has watched her evolve a unique hunting style.
She goes to the point of personally involving herself with them and talking to them as if they were human.
The rabbits are very confident. They've almost eaten.
As I leave for the day, Betsy is conferring with her pack and staff. And yes, occasionally a luckless bunny is dispatched in the course of a hunt. But this is not the aim.
Hounds will hunt forever with no reward.
But there is a reward. Praise and the elegiac sound of the horn that tells the pack their job is done. And what is our reward?
You hear the geese flying overhead. You see the sun setting in the distance. You see the fall flowers in the woods, and it's beautiful.
For Only a Game, I'm Sarah Montague in New York.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You're just old hound dog. Been snooping around my door. You can wag your tail, but I ain't gonna feed you no more. Oh, play the same more.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Jeremy Bernfeld and from Tony Federico at KPCC in Pasadena. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to see photos of the Sandinona Harehounds in action, listen to a reading of a traditional hunt diary, or revisit stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. In our final word, former Commissioner Fay Vincent sums up baseball's umpire problems with one simple analogy.
Umpires are viewed like the bases, like furniture. They're part of the game, the bases are, but they're not considered terribly important.
Well, okay, but furniture's pretty important. Just ask all those guys screaming at the umpires from their recliners. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.